Morning, everyone. God, you guys look better than you looked on Friday. Something must have happened over the weekend. Yeah, I want to thank Mike for asking me to speak. And I always like to start off with a little gratitude for AA, because AA was there when my family needed it, and my son is the alcoholic, and I know that you guys and Al-Anon, saved our family, and without AA, there's no Al-Anon. So I always appreciate AA and all the members. And one thing about the comment cards, if you could fill those out before I talk, that would be good. I'll just wait, and then I'll go ahead. So start out with a little joke. There's three alcoholics. It was a sponsor and a couple of sponsees, and they were going down this in this building. They found an old lamp, and they rubbed this lamp, and this genie pops out, and genie said, "I'm going to give each one of you one wish." So the first sponsee says, "Well, let's see. I want my own private island with lots of hot women and all the drugs and alcohol I can have." Poof, there he goes. He's off. Second sponsee says, "I want a mansion with all the money in the world and the hottest wife in the world." Poof, there he goes. He's off. So then he goes to the sponsor, and he said, "Oh, what would you like?" And I go, "I want both of those jokers back here in 5 minutes working on their four steps." Sponsors are party poopers. My whole thing about, the programs are, it's a message of hope. And, I didn't have a lot of hope before I got here. And, I've been around a while. I've been Al-Anon over 20 years. And I keep coming back to Al-Anon, not because I have alcoholics in my life. I don't really live with active drinking, but I found that when I keep coming back, I'm making spiritual deposits that they're necessary for when life shows up, and it shows up. It's a way for me to get out of my head and out of the way I used to think, and tap into something that's better than my experience, before Al-Anon. So I'm a native of Seattle area. I grew up here. I've never lived more than 30 minutes from the airport. I think I've lived in 8 different cities. Moved around a lot when we were first starting out, young and small kid. So this is my home, and I moved out. I had a really sweet deal. I was living at home. I graduated high school and working in a warehouse, and I was throwing my paychecks in the top drawer because, I had no bills. Mom was making my lunch, and I think car insurance back there was like $100 a year, and so me and friends would cash a couple paychecks, go buy some albums, and have fun. And And then that all got screwed up when I got a girlfriend and moved out, and started doing the real deal. And I met her at work, and she had I think I was 20, and she was 24, an older woman. That's pretty cool. And she had a 18-month-old son, and she had just gone through a divorce. So I wasn't like instant dad. I was just like instant boyfriend that kind of turned into dad. His paternal dad wasn't really involved and left state and didn't want to pay child support, and we were always trying to get him involved, and we ended up getting married 4 years later, and then 3 years later I ended up adopting him just because the dad wasn't in the picture anymore. So when I talk about my son, I don't think of him as an adopted son. It's just he's just Brandon. He's my son, you know, and that piece of paper doesn't mean much. But so yeah, we moved around, and I brought into that relationship everything that I grew up with, everything I learned, and I grew up in a house where you knew you were loved. We did a lot of things together. Dad and I would go hunting, and you know, we do family camping trips and always celebrate birthdays, and you know, we're always around family in the holidays, and so you knew you were loved, but the L word was never spoken. There was no hugs, and ever since I can remember, I was painfully shy. I just didn't know how to deal with social things, and the family jokes about it. It's like, it's a crown boy, and you know, we're all quiet and shy, and shyness is okay. It's just that the inability to express emotions and deal with emotions is pretty hard. I found that growing up, I tried to figure things out in my head all the time, and you know, if you're learning math or some kind of science or something, you know, you can do that and you can ask for help and learn that. But it's that emotional stuff that, with a child's brain, how do you manage that? And so, you know, you develop coping skills like everybody else. And, you know, one thing I like about Al-Anon and AA is how much I relate when other people share, especially early on. I thought I was the only one that didn't know how to do this. I thought I was the only one that had all these fears. I thought I was the only one that had to manipulate and lie and tell the story so I could look good or I could get what I wanted or so that you would like me. You know, and that's the big one, you know. We all want to fit in and early on in Al-Anon I was hearing, you know, my thought process was that I was down here and everybody else was up here and I had to do something fantastic to be up here. I had to be perfect so I could be average, you know, and you know, that's called the house always wins and I'm not the house. And then I hear some of you guys, AA and Al-Anon, talking about all these great things you did that I was trying to achieve so I could be like you. And you were talking about trying to get up to where I am, you know, and so it didn't matter if I was doing fantastic things or I was trying to do fantastic things. We were all doing the same thing, just trying to fit in. So a little bit about the history before I got here, you know. So we got married and moved around, and my son was having troubles in school, and he was ADD, and they put him on Ritalin, and then got into middle school, and he was behind in school. Teachers have kind of pushed him through with, and so it seemed like there was trouble socially, and it was just like there was always something going on with him that we were working on, and we're trying to fix, and we're trying to get help with, and at 13, that's kind of when the trouble started. I remember, you know, there's things that you remember like it was yesterday, and there's a lot of great things I remember going through this program like it was yesterday, and there were some tough things. And it's one of those tough things. We got a call. He was staying at a friend's house on Mercer Island, and, you know, grandma knew the family, so he's staying there fine. So the mom calls and said, the two 13-year-olds are missing, and so is my van. And, yeah, I didn't laugh. and one of the places we had lived saving for a house was, you know, with my in-laws on Mercer Island a few years prior, and we knew the ravines and the windy roads and the and we could, you know, just this pit of my stomach just sick, you know. And we go there and this started an aspect which I call mom radar. So, you know, mom and kid have this connection, and she's able to, you know, she's able to find this kid, you know, he could run away to South Dakota, and she'll say, oh, we got to go to South Dakota. You know, I don't know how that works, but so we go to Mercer Island, we drive there, and, you know, within 10 minutes we find him, and, you know, they just got pulled over by the police, and there was three phone books in the driver's seat because he couldn't reach the pedals, and it was just, you know, and then we found a pipe before the cops saw it. We found a pipe, so we just like pocketed that, saying, hey, they don't need to see that, and you know, and that was the start of it, you know, and that was kind of the start of trying to fix the problem or trying to deny the problem, you know, so in that case, we knew what the problem was. It was the other kid, bad influence, you know, and we heard stories about him. It's like, oh yeah, just stay away from that kid, you'll be fine. But he started hanging around with some of these kids that, you know, I don't know about those kids. There was a lot of things going on, crazy things. And you know, the thing about alcoholism that I've learned is that you don't go from normal to crazy in a day, you know, because if you did that, you would see this is crazy. Something's going on. Let's deal with it. But the craziness just starts up and up and up. It's like that frog in the water scenario where you just keep turning up the heat. And I did not see the effects on my family. I didn't see the effects on me. It's just, and I'm sure outside people, family and friends and stuff could start seeing that, but I couldn't. So age 14, some stuff happened, and so we're going to counseling, and at age 14, the counselor says, well, we've done an evaluation on your son, and he is an alcoholic and a level blah, blah, drug addict. And I was just floored, you know. Shock. You know, I can't even respond. And so we drive home, and, you know, my wife has to work, you know, the effect on me, I didn't know this, but we got home, and I don't know what my son was doing, but I just went in the kitchen, and I just sat on a bench in the kitchen, and I thought I was having a nervous breakdown, but I don't know. It was like this. I couldn't move, and I couldn't think, and there was part of my brain was saying, you've got to move, you've got to do something, and I was just frozen for I don't know how long until the phone rang, and I told my wife about it, and she says, you got to do something. And so I leapt into action. We fired that counselor. He didn't know what he was talking about. And we're going to handle this. So we went on our way and started fixing, you know. Oh, it's the school, you know, it's the kids, you know. And so we go to borrow some money, put them in private school. That'll fix the situation, you know. So there was always a fix. But to get him into that private school, he had to pass eighth grade. And I swear I was at the school more than he was. I was pushing those teachers, give him the extra credit, you know, and do this. Somewhere in there, I think it was a school counselor or something, said, you know, sometimes you just got to let people fail so they can learn, you know. And I responded to that by saying, that's a bunch of shit, you know, because I was holding on to was this fear. You know, I saw in my wisdom that, you know, if this happens and this happens and this happens and this happens, you know, and I had his life planned out where, you know, if you don't do this or if this happens, there you go. And that was a pattern of mine that I didn't learn until I was in Al-Anon, and just how I live my life is trying to figure out how to avoid this tragedy, you know, because I'd go down that thing and then I'd have to be focused on avoiding that thing. You know, there, I narrowed down my vision and my choices so much, you know, that by the time I got to Al-Anon, my sponsor called it funnel vision, you know, not tunnel vision, but funnel. I just funneled it all down, and there was like, you know, you could do this or this, right or wrong, and I was totally black and white. And got him into private school, his friends, I think three quarters of the way through that, his friends actually turned him in because they were worried about his drinking and drug use. And I could never see it. I could never see it happening, because he was like this dual personality. His normal personality is he can't get away with anything. You know, there's a trail of breadcrumbs everywhere. You know, and who broke this? Who ate this? Who did this? You know, and he's the only kid in the house. And I didn't do it. Well, what's that thing under your bed? You know, the evidence is right there. So he couldn't get away with anything. Drugs and alcohol. We had an alarm system in the house, and we had a small dog. So downstairs, you know, about the last 2 feet, the alarm wasn't working. So he would crawl on his hands and belly and get to the one window that didn't have a sensor on it and sneak out and then come back. And, oh, my God, that guy was clever. And these are the things we found out afterwards. But, alcoholics can be some crafty people. If he only put some of that effort into school, I mean, he'd be a genius, you know. But, you know, got to have your priorities. So they kicked him out of school, and they did an assessment, and they said that, well, they said that he could come back to school if he did an assessment. So he did an assessment, and they again said he's an alcoholic. And this time we had to do treatment. That was a low point in my life. I felt, and we felt, like we were the only parents in Bellevue, and we were the worst parents. And I, you know, what's everybody going to think? And then I'm pissed at him because I now know the truth. You know, and all this sneaking around and lying and deceptiveness. And why is he doing this? Why is he doing this to us? You know, he has got no moral code. And for me, I compared him to myself when I was his age. And, you know, growing up, I was the good boy. On the outside, I was the good boy. I followed the rules and I pleased the people and I did what you wanted me to do. So I can feel good about myself. You're going to give me some positive feedback and that all works great. And so when I didn't want to be the good boy, then I would do things, but I would just be smart about it. You know, you just cover your tracks, and if you don't get caught, it doesn't count. And he didn't know how to do that. But I was getting my schoolwork done, and I was responsible for most of the time. And I'm just saying, you know, and I started the lecture series, and, you know, this was a lecture series that, you know, my wife and my son and myself got to participate in weekly, and they started rolling their eyes, and then after a while, I realized I was in the, it was like, you ever have those out-of-body experiences where, like, you're somewhere, and then you just kind of see yourself doing it, and I'm doing the lecture series on what he should do right and wrong, and all of a sudden, I was thinking, God, this is boring. This, I can't stand this anymore, you know, and I can't stand myself, but that was the only, that's my funnel vision. You know, this is the right way, and if you would just do this, you know, does anybody else relate to that? If you would just do what I say, everything's going to be okay, because God knows I know what you should do. I have no clue what I should do, but I know what should happen in this situation, and I can predict the future. So I remember driving into Sundown M Ranch over there in Sela and just thinking, this is the worst day of my life, you know. I just had to go, I went to my dad, I had to borrow money, I had to tell him the story, I felt like this big, and of course, you know, he's not judging me or anything, I'm just doing that to myself, and we drive in, and it's just the worst day, I'm so embarrassed, and we stayed overnight, and the next day, and so we go to this first meeting, and it's just just the parents, because it's all children. And we go to this meeting, and we're sitting in a circle, and there's all these other parents from all these other cities in Washington. And so, number one, I get, okay, I'm not alone. So that's good. That's what I get out of Al-Anon is, you know, I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one that feels like this. I'm not the only one dealing with something like this. Oh, my situation, I can see it's troubling, but I can kind of get some perspective. So we've got other parents talking, and we're talking. And I have no – growing up, I have no connection with a higher power. We didn't go to church. I had some judgments about religious people, you know, contempt prior to investigation. But, you know, it was just something that wasn't my deal. And so, yeah, do whatever you want. Just don't tell me about it. And I know today that I've always had a higher power working in my life. It's just that I never turned on the switch, opped up the shades, whatever you want to say. But that weekend, there was definitely something working in my life. And so we go to this presentation, and, you know, I'm so embarrassed about alcoholic kid, and just, you know, I'm thinking this bum in the gutter, and, you know, this is, you know, the perception that we have when we don't know about things. And they do this 30-minute presentation on alcoholism as disease, and they go through, you know, some of the physiological stuff and everything, and how the brain and works different, processes it different, and all these different aspects of that. And, you know, for me, if I'm going to learn something and you're going to convince me of something, you know, I've got to read all the literature and do all the research. And then, you know, somewhere years down the road, I'll go, oh, okay, I get it. You know, I believe it. And, you know, I saw that and I got it. And the big thing about that was that it was a disease. What they said, it was a no-fault disease, you know, and that one just went right through me, because I'm, you know, I don't like taking the blame. So, you know, when things happen, it's usually someone else's fault. And I can do that in overt or covert ways, but, you know, I was blaming him for everything, you know, and, you know, his choices. And I got it that he really didn't have a choice in that, you know. And it's not my fault. It's not how I raised him. It's not what I did or didn't do, or what we did or didn't do, what he did or didn't do. That was huge, you know. And I remember that night they wanted us to write a hopeful and uplifting letter for them, so if they're having a tough time, they can read it, you know, and say, we're here for you, we're supporting you, you know, we're praying for you, whatever you want to say. And I remember writing that down, and I was just crying. And, you know, that's probably the first time in, I don't know, 5-10 years that I cried. You know, we just don't do that. You know, I've been to a lot of funerals, and all the guys around me, all my family, you know, there was like 2 women that would cry, you know, and those were the criers, and the rest of us were just stoic. So it was a pretty incredible experience. And then, you know, and somewhere in there they said that you should go to Al-Anon. You should start going to Al-Anon now, so when he's back in 28 days, that you have some under your belt. And what I heard about Al-Anon, you know, what I heard was, oh, I go to Al-Anon to keep them sober. And they're going to tell me how to keep that person sober. So that's great. That's good. That's a good thing. And I think what they were saying is you need to go there to deal with how you are doing. And that went right over my head, because I am doing fine as long as he's doing fine, and I'm doing shitty as long as he's doing shitty, you know. And so my emotions, that's not part of the deal, you know. Let's focus on the problem here, and that's not me. And let's fix the problem. And so we got the call 2 weeks later that he got kicked out of treatment for fighting over cigarettes, and the panic was back on. And, of course, we hadn't gone to Al-Anon yet. And so my wife drove over there because she could take off time from work. And he got back, and – You know, we were on pins and needles, and then we went to Al-Anon. And so I started my first Al-Anon meeting in Bellevue at the Bellevue Alano Club. And I didn't know what I was going to see there, what I was going to hear there. And I go there, and people are talking about real stuff, real feelings, dirty laundry, stuff that you would never talk to even family members about, right? And you're telling me this, you're saying this in front of me. I don't even know you. And so again, I think my higher power was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself that day. Was my MO would be, this is perfect. This is emotional. Wife, you go here, you go to Al-Anon, I'll stay here. You know, I've got the plan. You know, you get the information from Al-Anon, and we'll meet this head on. But I don't know why, but I decided to go back to my second meeting. And I always say that, you know, people say that one of the hardest things or bravest things you could do is go to your first Al-Anon meeting. And I think it's the second meeting is the hardest, because, you know, I knew something about, you know, what was in store for me. And there was something there that said go. And I learned a big lesson in that second meeting, because the lesson I learned is you never know where your teachers are going to come from. You know, I was good at judging people and sizing you up by your car or by your face or by your clothes or by your job or by your, you know, just the way you look at me. And so this 19-year-old girl, her name was Sky. I saw her once in my life, and that was that moment. She started talking about us and being so supportive for our son, and I don't know exactly what she said, but I started crying in a meeting, my second meeting. And this is very embarrassing. I'm crying in front of people I don't know. And at the end of that meeting, that embarrassment was wiped away, because I felt so good. You know, it just, to be real in front of people, you know, that's what the programs are about. And so I kept going back, and weird times, you know, like how do you start unraveling all your thought process and look at things you haven't looked at before, and in early times the focus was on him and what's he doing and blah 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 blah, and then gradually it shifts over to me. But the first 6 weeks were pretty good, because, you know, all of a sudden, you know, he's back, he's going outpatient, he's going to AA, he's like on this pink cloud, and everything's great, you know. So hey, everything's great with him, everything's great with me. And so I was Mr. Al-Anon. This is great stuff, you know, and, you know, we're the successful family, and wife and I are going to Al-Anon, he's going to AA, we're all happy. And so about 6 weeks later, it's like, oh, it's August, I really should, you know, we're going to paint the house, take a couple weekends off, so I won't go to Al-Anon for a little bit. So I didn't go to Al-Anon for about 3 weeks, and I thought everything was fine. And then he took a little nosedive, and I took that nosedive, and I felt that, because all of a sudden I went from here to being up here. And then when I took that nosedive, you know, I won't hit that. I felt that. I felt that. And it's not the gradual everything's degrading and I'm getting used to it things. And I felt that pain. And what really got me back was the 7-page phone bill. And I got a phone bill, and apparently he got a girlfriend out of area. So I get the phone bill, and it's like, well, that's pretty thick. Must be a lot of ads in here, you know. And I open it up, and it's like, oh. You know, I think he was laying on the couch or something and doing nothing. And I think he saw the terror in my eyes, because I said, you better get your ass out there and get some yard work done. And he's like, phew. And, uh, The next morning, I went to my Al-Anon meeting. I was so pissed. I was just fuming as I was driving to the Al-Anon meeting. I said, oh, I'm just going to rant and rave, and I'm going to talk about this stuff. And, you know, and the funny thing is I went to that meeting. I didn't say a word. I just listened. And at the end of the meeting, I had one of those out-of-body experiences again, and I saw myself laughing and hugging and talking with people, and I had not even touched that subject. And, you know, and that's the miracle of the program for me is that, you know, sometimes I have to work really hard, and I'm working the steps, and I'm working on this problem, and I got to let this thing go, and you know, talk to a lot of people, and sometimes it just happens. And so I knew, you know, that day was the day that, you know, I stopped coming for him, and I started coming for me, because I needed some help. And, you know, and getting to that point, you know, I knew there was a lot of work ahead. I got a sponsor and I picked a guy that thought exactly like me. And I just, you know, I just related to him when he was sharing and that's what I've learned, you know, in the program. You know, I go to men's meetings and I go to mixed meetings and I like them both. And I get a lot out of them both, but there's something about a men's meeting where it's just, you know, that is where I learned what a real man was. You know, a real man is not the macho guy that has all the toys and, you know, talks the talk. You know, these guys were talking about being afraid and being sad and not knowing answers and being depressed or doing things they don't want to do and feeling guilty and right in front of everybody. And that is a powerful thing. You know, I just feel so blessed that I got into the program and so I had to look at myself and one of the things I looked at was, you know, honesty and someone started sharing about honesty and, you know, the difference between cash register honesty and emotional honesty. And, you know, that one hit me right there. And because I didn't want people to know, you know, I felt so alone or so different. And so that's one of the big things. Now, some people have talked in this weekend about, you know, boundaries and how do you set boundaries and how do you know you're not helping someone, or, you know, when is it help and when is it enabling, and that was a tough thing for us, because I had a son that, you know, I'm morally and financially and legally responsible for when he was under 18, and so I had to start letting go of some of those control issues, and I had to start. I had to change my mindset of my boundaries aren't to control you and make sure you do what I think you should do. My boundaries are for my comfort, you know. So if you're in my house, this is for our comfort. So we started out with this list of rules on the refrigerator where it was like this long, you know, and then we went into legal action, and he was arguing his side and we were arguing our side, and it was just this, yeah. And quite quickly it got down to, you know, well, you've got to be a contributing member of the household, and there's a couple, you know, you got to treat us with respect and a couple other things. And the hard part about that is, you know, letting go of that fear over here. This is going to happen if I let go. And so it wasn't, you know, we talk about detaching. It's like detach from that person and try to stay out of that person's stuff while still being in a relationship. Well, for me, it's not that person. It's my fears. And, you know, if I can deal with my fears and I can have, you know, if I can get some kind of faith in something other than myself and other than my fears, something bigger, then I can start having healthy boundaries. I can start detaching. I can start being in relationship. So I started working with steps with the sponsor, and one of the things that helped me with my second and third step. I'm praying to something. You know, my sponsor was the same as me. Didn't want a higher power or anything when he started, and he had this great connection with something he couldn't explain to me. And I said, okay, well, let me try. You know, so I just started praying to something that I didn't know what it was, and it felt weird at the beginning, and I just started doing it. But I remember this incident. My wife was at my wife did a minor surgery, and she was in recovery at the hospital. So I was sitting by her bedside, and she was still in her anesthesia, kind of out of it. And so I'm reading my Al-Anon book, and I think I'm reading on the third step. And I get the call from my son. You know, now he's gone back to regular school, and he's trying to stay sober and do school and do all that stuff. And then he calls me, and he says, "Dad, I'm in a little bit of trouble at school. Can you meet me in 10 minutes? And, you know, this is like 7 at night. And it's like, oh, shit, here we go again, you know. So I get into my car, and before I get in my car, I just say this little prayer. It's just, God, just help me. And so I meet him, and I get in the car, and, you know, he's done something stupid, but he said, you know, I might get caught at this, but I might not. So I might get away with it, but if I don't, I get caught, then this could be some consequences. Well, that could be a hot button for me. I see a lot of things over here. And something came over me, and I listened to him. But no fear, no judgment, no even inkling of what he should do. And we talked about options, and at the end of that, I just said, you know, you'll make the decision that's right for you. You know, that was not me. That was not me. Sometimes I'll work on a step or I'll work on an issue, and I just need to hang in there until, you know, those situations come up, and then it works. It's kind of like spiritual bank account. You may have heard that, but, you know, just keep on making your deposits, because life is going to show up, things are going to happen, things are going to change, and you're going to need to make that withdrawal. And so that's why I go to meetings. That's why I get a sponsor. That's why I work the steps. That's why I do service. That's, you know, it's the whole deal. And Al-Anon for me, it's like anything. And they said, you know, the more you work it, the more you get out of it, just like anything. And, you know, I heard that early on. And it's like, the more you give, the more you get. And it's like, yeah, whatever, you know, how much money do you want type thing, you know. And it's not that way. It is not that way. And I got into service early, you know, not by choice, but, you know, probably by divine intervention. I was going to that Kirkland midweek men's meeting on Wednesdays, and as one of my meetings, and it was a fairly new meeting, and the GR had to leave, and so they said, anybody that can be a GR and, you know, make this commitment, step forward. And I think everybody stepped backwards, and so that was me. Okay, that's me. And I'm not a joiner type. I'm not a leader type. I don't want this, and it was the best thing for me. I started going to district meetings. I was meeting people. My son's going to Al-Anon, and I remember we went, you know, a little bit later, there was a gratitude dinner or something, and I was there early. My son was there with me, and I was helping set up, you know, and I was just saying hi to people as people were coming in and blah, 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 like you do, and, you know, just doing the deal. And then my son comes up to me later, and he says, "Dad, what's going on?" I said, "What are you talking about?" He says, "You know everybody here." It's like, yeah, that is not me, you know. It's like, I'm usually in the corner going, okay, yeah, I'll do the dishes or something back here. And that was really good feedback. So, kind of fast forward, he, if you would have put 115-year-old sober kids in a room and said, that's the one that's going to stay sober for years. I would have said, no, that's not going to happen. It's like, and that was the odds. It's like, oh, shit, you know, this isn't going to go well. And, you know, and he stayed sober to his credit for 7 years. And, you know, he was in AA and he would get into it and then he would kind of phase out of it. But he was always around it and having sponsors and, you know, and he had to change friends about every 2 weeks because, you know, these guys are coming into AA and then they're getting drunk and they're going back out, you know, young people. And I was complaining one day that I was like, God, he doesn't have a job. He doesn't have this. He's smoking cigarettes, blah, blah, blah. And then someone came up to me, and, you know, in the program and said, is he sober? I said, oh, yeah. What was your life like 2 years ago? You know, it's like, oh, yeah. And, you know, perspective. That's what the program gives me. So fast forward, you know, he's 22 and you know, him and his friends are kind of hanging out bars but not drinking and just doing fun. And so he calls me up, my wife and myself, and he says, Dad, I'm not an alcoholic. I don't think I ever was an alcoholic. And, you know, I think I could just drink socially. And so I just went off on him and how wrong that was and how he knew this and how, you know, and I did that for 30 seconds and then I stopped. And then I said, but I can't change anything. And I love you. I don't like what you're doing, but I'm always going to love you. And that's the gift of Al-Anon. You know, before, if my son was doing bad things, I was thinking bad things about him. You know, if you're trying and you're working on it, I'm in. I love you. I'm helping you. And if you're not, screw you. You know, I had that detachment, and I remember there was times where we'd be walking down the hallway. He'd be coming towards me, and I'd be coming towards him, and I wouldn't even look at him, not even acknowledge him. And that doesn't feel good. And so I know that the programs saved our family, because if I was not in a program and my wife and my son were, I'm out. You know, I can't deal with that stuff. I have to have this. I have to work on myself. That was a whole different ball game. So I was involved in service, and I was going to the service meetings. Thank you. And the district meetings, and they started this thing. It was a very first year. The DR says, let's do an Al-Anon retreat. You know, AA have all these retreats and everything. Let's do an Al-Anon retreat just for Al-Anon. And so he put up his own money, and you know, a bunch of us went to Fort Worden. Actually, this was before I was going to the CAMA weekend at Fort Worden. So it was called Serenity on the Sound. It's still going. It was at Fort Worden for a few years, and now it's here every year, I believe. And so I go, and my wife goes, and there's like 35 people, and I know about 8 people, and you know, that's an element where I usually just kind of close in a little bit. I don't know people. I'll just kind of fill it out. And again, it's out-of-body experience. You know, something happened, and I was sharing things on the fly that I didn't even know were in me with people I didn't even know, all weekend long, and I'm having these connections. And I remember this candlelight meeting Saturday night, and I was just feeling this huge loss, you know, all these things I'm learning at Al-Anon, and I just thought about my whole life and all these fun situations and happenings that I could have been involved in, but I couldn't, because I just couldn't put myself out there, you know, and I just felt so sad. And then I got angry at my parents because they didn't give me what I needed, and I'm just feeling all this stuff. And one of the biggest things I learned in Al-Anon, one of the sayings is, you know, that, you know, we all did the best we could with what we had at the time. And I had to use that to just like, okay, you know, my parents, how did they grow up? You know, their parents passed that on to them. They passed it on to me. I carried it into my life until I got into Al-Anon. So, you know, I gotta switch that around. I gotta look at the gratitude. I gotta look at the now. But I have to honor those feelings. And that's one of my traps is I could I could get caught in a feeling, I could get caught in a situation from the past or project in the future, and I'm not dealing with what's going on today. So my it was quite a journey. And then I got to go to the CAMA meetings after I got the balls to go with a true men's retreat, you know, because I knew about your retreat, you CAMA guys, because I'm up here in Kirkland, and I was like, no, I'll stick with Serenity on the Sound because, you know, it's comfortable for me, but, you know, what about a bunch of guys on the weekend, and I know better, it's Al-Anon, it's, you know, we're cool about it, but I just thought it was this macho thing, you know, and I'm not alone there. I've heard a lot of guys out there saying, yeah, I heard about it, but I'm not going to go this year, I've dragged some people there and just so they can experience the miracles. So there's been some talk about, you know, this weekend about Al-Anon and AA and, you know, should I go, should I not? And, I have no advice on that, but I can tell you by experience that I've been witness to a lot of guys at the Kirkland Men's meeting and at the CAMA meeting, a lot of AA members that come in, and the ones that have got in the program, got a sponsor, been a little bit open-minded about looking at the steps a little differently, almost every one of those guys has really blossomed and really got a lot out of that. And so, you know, we say go to six different meetings. Well, I got a better idea, you know. Go to the CAMA Fort Worden weekend, you know. Just immerse yourself in it, you know, and that's where the miracles happen. I can't promise you a refund if you don't have a spiritual awakening, but I can promise you we're going to have a good time whether you are or not. So you're invited. And I'll get off my soapbox on that one. So I got to get current. 10 minutes? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, life shows up. I went through a divorce. let me change the subject. Let me go back a few years. I went through a divorce. My wife and I were both in Al-Anon. This is the quick story. We kind of were drifting apart, you know, with the sex thing, you know, and we just couldn't. She had this really baggage from horrible situations with previous guys, and, you know, and we'd gone to counseling and stuff, but we just never could meet, you know, meet in the middle on that. And, you know, after a while, you just kind of drift apart. And we were friends, and, you know, it was decided we were gonna get a divorce, and so I ended up moving out, and it's the first time I'm on my own since moving out of my house at age 20. You know, I've never lived on my own. And this is the first time I really experienced to the full extent grief and loss. And, you know, what I did, not intentional, but what happened was that I stopped my filters. I stopped trying to manage those feelings. I let the guard down, and I let those feelings of loss and grief and sadness and anger and everything just wash over me. And something incredible happened is, you know, I thought, old idea, if you're in pain and grief, you just need to follow that down and just always be there. And then when you're at the bottom, then you come back up and then you'll be happy, you know. And so if it's 6 months or 6 years, there you go. And that's pretty logical. And what happened was, in the same day, I was able to just be on my knees crying or doing whatever. And then hours later, be laughing and be happy and enjoying life. I didn't think that was possible. And I said to myself, you know, it's been 20-year marriage. I'm not going to date until I'm ready, you know. And I did some work on myself, and I got healthy. I'm at the peak of my spirituality. I mean, I'm not even trying to be, and I'm washing the dishes and just floating on the air. Woo-hoo, you know. A little crazy, but in a good way. And then, you know, I see her. I'm ready. And it's my coworker, and I've been working with her a long time, and I didn't even see her. And, you know, you know, we felt like after we started dating and, you know, got married and everything that, you know, we just felt like we were soulmates, and, you know, we were just felt like we were put together. And, you know, she was, when I met her, she was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and had some Al-Anon. I didn't know this. I just knew she had a bumper sticker that looked interesting. And, but I, you know, I wasn't connected down here. I had moved down into the South End again in the Auburn, Kent area. And so we, just had this fantastic relationship, you know, we went through a lot of tough stuff, you know, with careers and kids and parents and, you know, the things that show up. And the thing about it was that, you know, we had this common priorities, common language, and we were just, you know, everything was okay, even the things that weren't, it was okay. And you know, she had a smile that could light up a room. And an infectious laugh. Most caring person I ever met. So she was having some health problems last year, and thought it was related to menopause, and she was working with her primary doctor on that, and it was getting a little bit worse and different things, and so they scheduled an MRI just to rule things out, and we go to the ER. Got it. Good. That's all I'm good for. So we go to the ER, and they, you know, it's got to get there at 5 a.m. It's like, okay, we'll do this, and we'll go home, and we'll take a nap and go back to work, you know, just to, we're just doing the deal. And they say, we got your image, and you need to report to emergency, and the doctor will meet you there. And they had found a 2.5-inch tumor in the center of her brain. So that was not good news, and so they transport her to UW Medical Center, and the next day they're going to do a biopsy, and you know, and again it's like, okay, this doesn't look good, but you know, we'll take the biopsy and we'll see what it is, and we'll go from there, and so they. And, you know, we'll do the biopsy, and you'll be in the hospital for a day, and then you go home, and you'll get the results in a few days. And so they did biopsy, and the next day she couldn't talk and had all sorts of reactions. And, you know, and so, you know, spent that week at the hospital with her most of the time, and we thought it was reaction to the powerful steroids. And they did another scan just to make sure there was no bleeding or anything going on there. Everything looked like it worked perfect. So I'm in the hospital with her, just, you know, and everybody knows about this, and everybody says they're praying for me, and you know, okay, that's great. You're praying for me, but I got this shit going on, right? I didn't think much of it, and that was the hardest time of my life, and I'm meeting with teams of doctors, and they're trying to figure things out, and they're getting bad news, or we're having difficulties, and every time I just couldn't do anything again, which was several times a day, you know, I had this physical feeling, this spiritual thing, just, I mean, it was there 24/7 when I needed it. It was just like, okay, I can't do this again. Now I got four more doctors to talk to, and then boom, I'm there, I'm aware, I'm cognizant, I'm dealing with this stuff. You know, and then I'll go feel my feelings over here, and then I'm back, and You know, when people say they're praying for you, or when you're praying for somebody, my experience is miracles happen. I mean, and I needed that through this whole period. It was Wednesday. I'd been there since Friday, and I'm just not dealing with everything, you know, and I have to, and I got to go to that Kirkland men's meeting. And I got to go over there, you know. I got to go over there, and I'm going to go. And I was like, I'm so tired, I can't drive. And I call my friend Chuck. He picks me up, drives me over there, and you know, I know the guys over there. And they go out to dinner, and so he buys me dinner, and I'm with the guys. I sit down, and I just tell everybody, all right, nobody talk to me. I don't want to talk about anything. That's my way of saying thank you for picking me up and buying me dinner. And they're all just, you know, so they just go on talking amongst themselves, like, it's okay, no problem. And, the gift of the program is I got to go there in front of 35 guys, tell them what's going on in my life, and just break down. And I go back to the hospital, and it's like a reset button, isn't it? Sometimes, where you just go in and you're just at the end of your rope, and bam, I'm ready to go. And you know, we're in a hospital, and then we find out, you know, it's the very worst news you can get. It's the most aggressive type of tumor, right in the center of the brain, inoperable. And maybe you have, I thought they said 12 to 16 months. But a few days later, they were talking, and they said 12 to 16 weeks. And I checked with my stepdaughter, and they said they always have said that. I heard what I wanted to hear. Tough news. And so she had to make a decision, and or we did, and decided to do hospice at home and, you know, do the deal. She was diagnosed December 9th, and she passed away on January 11th. And pretty fast. So, you know, I'm a little over 7 weeks into this, and you know, it's the people of the program have picked me up. Gordy called me and said, I have a team of people waiting, but we're not going to do anything until you say so. You know, that's the gift of Al-Anon. You know, we're not going to save you, but if you need to be saved, you need to call. And I got, you know, when we got home from the hospital, and I made it about 6 hours. I said, I got this. And then after I ran into the wall for about the 14th time, it's like, okay, I don't got this. And I called, and, you know, we had volunteers at our house 18 hours a day, AA and Al-Anon. We had people taking care of bills. We had people taking care of grandkids. We had people driving people somewhere. We had people responding to emergencies. I mean, I just called, and, you know, people coming up to the hospital to be with me. You know, it's a family program. You know, it's a fellowship, and you know, and I know, I heard some good things last night in the grief meeting, some really hopeful things. And I know, you know, I need to do. I need to focus on letting go. I need to focus on what good has come from this or will come from this. And I have experienced those things along with the pain and the sorrow and the thought that I... It's the same thought I had when I was divorced. I will never be loved again. I screwed up, or I missed out my chance, you know. And, now I have even more excuse. I mean, this was the perfect soulmate. You know, now nobody will ever compare to that. And I know that's true if I hold on to that and if I compare that and if I use that as my marker. So I'm getting outside help on the grief. People are still supporting me, calling me. I had to call the ladies and say, stop with the meals already. My freezer is full, getting fat. And I would not have that if I didn't have a sponsor, work the steps, do service, stay in the game, and show up to things like this. So thank you.